Hello and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm Bill Barton, a solicitor who lives and breathes construction and engineering law. At Barton Legal, we help clients in the UK and around the world on everything from litigation and arbitration to drafting and negotiating contracts. And in this podcast, we unpack the latest legal trends and problems facing the industry, providing you with straight-talking insights to help break down these complex legal questions. So, let's get on with today's episode. Hi, and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm really, really happy today to be joined by someone I admire greatly. I've known for not long enough at all, Dr. Donald Charrett. I always forget that you are, in fact, a doctor. There's just no end to your talents and qualifications. So, Donald, how are you?
I'm very well, Bill, and thank you for the opportunity of talking with you.
I have to say, you're very lucky because I came in this morning. It's the 31st of January, and probably still just about is for you as well. We'll come on to where you are. But it's freezing here. It's like 4 degrees. The road's being gritted. I mean, you're in Melbourne. So do you ever see a gritter?
I don't know what a gritter is, although I assume it's something to de-ice the roads and make sure you don't slide off.
Indeed it is. And isn't that funny that you've never seen a gritting lorry? It just, these are silly things in people's lives, that you live in countries and you just have no idea that people won't experience. So tell me, it's towards the end of the day for you. So what's the weather been like for you today? Just to give me hope for what might come in the peak of our British summer.
Oh, about 25 degrees with the sun shining all day, no rain, very pleasant day.
Thank you very much. That was a great podcast from Donald Charrett. Thank you. I can just picture that. Having been to Melbourne, what a great city. I suppose in July we might get up to 25 degrees. But so we're going to flit around today. We're going to talk about lots of different things. The aim is to allow people to have a small glimpse of a little bit more about you and to get to know you. I've just noticed that we're both wearing check shirts. You're like little check shirt buddies here. And I have to tell the audience, of course, we didn't coordinate on our wardrobes. I think my children, they're adults. My sons are 22 and my daughter's 27. But, I mean, they are children, but it makes it sound as if they're 4 or something. They would just say that we're clearly simpatico in age. but I'd like to think there's a couple of years between us.
So I will point out that I'm wearing a short-sleeved shirt, whereas I rather suspect yours is a long-sleeved flannel shirt.
I think you might find that I'm also wearing, undressing on a podcast, you might find that I'm actually wearing a Yorkshire t-shirt underneath and a check shirt and a jacket on the top with a hood, and I came in a hat and scarf. So yeah, I mean, when you're planning visits abroad, do you sort of think, I'm not going there because it will be cold? Do you ever plan visits abroad by weather?
Well, if it's a holiday, yes, particularly if I'm taking my wife, because she's not at all keen on coming to London in December or January or February, for that matter. But then in terms of most of my travel is for business purposes, and one doesn't have a lot of choice when it comes to destinations or the weather. One has to live with what's there at the time. It always pays, of course, to check beforehand to make sure you have the right clothes, and particularly when I can't do England, a raincoat and an umbrella
and a jumper. I mean, that is one of the issues of foreign business travel, that in this country, as with you, I'm sure there are lots and lots of weather apps that you can look at in your phone, but I think most of us have sort of given up trusting them. And then you go abroad and you think, I'm not going to bother. And I've lost count of the number of times I've turned up and thought, I really should have brought a jumper, or I should have not brought this jumper, because that's more often the case. I've taken a jumper and a coat and it's absolutely boiling, and you arrive in the airport and you're thinking, this is just going to be hot.
Well, one of the problems about flying to the tropics is that it might be very hot when you get there, but it can be very cold with the plane on the way. So I've taken to packing a jumper in my hand luggage.
That's good, but I've got over the embarrassment of just asking for a blanket. You know, that my young adults who I've spawned, they think that's very much an old person gig. Yeah, I'm not embarrassed about asking for a blanket on a plane and saying I'm cold. But
your role in life as a parent is to embarrass your children anyway. That's one of the requirements. If you're not embarrassing your children, you're not doing a very good job.
And I think that is right. It's one of the things I think on a CV I probably excel at. Although it's unfortunate, isn't it? You'll know the same thing. There are times when you can enjoy embarrassing your children, but there are other times you're desperately trying not to embarrass them because you know, and those are the times you actually do it. You embarrass them, and they look at you, and you're there saying, "Oh, I feel I'm sorry, I don't know." So, do your children still sort of say you've embarrassed me?
Not very often anymore. I think they're more at the stage of embarrassing their own children, because I have grandchildren ranging in age from 15 to 25. So, I think I'm past embarrassing my kids.
Do you still, at 15 to 25, are you still sort of the spoil them granddad?
Or absolutely. That's one of the great pleasures of being a grandparent.
And undermining the parent's authority. That's what I'm actually looking forward to. So how did you end up in Melbourne as your sort of city of choice?
Oh, well, that was pretty easy. I was born there, and I've lived there for most of my life, apart from 1 year when I lived and worked in Perth. But Perth's a long way from the eastern states of Australia. It's a big country town in many ways, and doesn't have the appeal of Melbourne, which is a much bigger city.
And despite all your travels, you've never been tempted to move permanently abroad? Anyway.
Not to move permanently, no. I do enjoy travelling and seeing different countries. I think the differences in different places is what makes them interesting. But I haven't yet found anywhere I'd rather live permanently than Melbourne, in spite of the weather. I mean, it's not as bad as England, but it can be very, very changeable. They do say about Melbourne weather, you know, if you don't like it, wait a minute, because it'll change. We get four seasons in one day.
Yeah, I've seen your four seasons, and they're not quite the same as ours. And do you think it's because you've had that benefit of travelling over a long period of time that, you know, it's given you that sort of sanctuary of, you know, you come back to home, and that's been a reason, you know, because you've had the best of both worlds.
I have, because there are things I like doing that requires a permanent base, like my carpentry hobby. You know, it's a bit hard to take a workshop around the world to different places. Melbourne's always good to come back to.
And you mentioned your carpentry element. So is that something you came to, you know, later or earlier? I mean, it's not a very transportable hobby, is it? It's not sort of like running or cycling.
No, that's right. It does need a certain set of equipment. But I have been doing carpentry, I think, since I was about 12. So I've been doing it for a very long time. Things have changed a bit over the that period, mostly in the form of more sophisticated tools, but the basics are still the same, and I still get the same enjoyment out of designing something from the timber that I have available, sometimes repurposing old timber into new uses. But it's something that I can do, you know, without very sophisticated technology, and I think I can actually understand what I'm doing, which is not necessarily the case with all the technology we deal with these days.
And you have something that's lasting. Have you ever been tempted to sort of sneak a decent chunky bit of wood in your suitcase and take home?
Not really, no. When I was in Tasmania a year or so back, I didn't actually sneak them. I had to buy them, but I did buy some Huon pine, which is a very fine softwood timber, extremely expensive, and these days very hard to get. But haven't worked out what to do with this timber yet, but that's often the case. I've got a stack of timber in my workshop just waiting for the inspiration as to what I can make with it.
What are the sort of things that inspire you? What makes you decide, either when you're wood or elsewhere?
Sometimes it's a matter of having some wood and thinking what I can make out of it that will be useful around the house. I've made over the years things like stools. A year or so back, I made the most ambitious project I've ever undertaken, a dining table of my own design, made in blackwood. It's about 2.1 metres long and 1 metre wide. I had to join a whole lot of pieces together, and I was very worried that they might not come out completely flat, but ended up being very successful, and I got a great deal of pleasure out of completing that.
And that must be... must be incredibly satisfying, because it's the ability to touch, isn't it? Touch and actually feel the thing that you've finished and done. But it's an interesting thing, because with, you know, I like running and cycling, and I used to play a lot of hockey, but you don't get that same sort of feeling, because you get an inner feeling of sort of fitness. But do you know what I mean? It's not something you can actually hold in your hands, is it? You can't hold fitness in your hand. You can't touch it. You just have to. It's a passing moment, and it doesn't last in the same way either. But I would talk about some of your qualifications, but we just, unless we had a couple of hours, there just isn't time, because the list is extensive. Most people are happy with having a qualification, but you actually qualified as an engineer, and then a little bit later, and we'll sort of come back to the bits and pieces, and then you taught, and then you became a solicitor, and then you did some other things, and then you became counsel, barrister, and now you sit both as a tribunal, member of a tribunal as well. So when you were 12, because you mentioned 12 because you sort of started your hobby then. Can you remember as a 12, 13, as a teenager, having, I mean, I presume you've got a very good maths understanding to be an engineer, and maths also comes into carpentry about understanding angles and the way you cut wood and things. Did you think you'd have all these different progressions in your career? What were you thinking what were you thinking at 13?
I was thinking I was going to be an engineer, and I think I assumed I'd be an engineer for the rest of my life. You mentioned the mathematics, and I guess that's one of the reasons why I went into engineering, because I've always had an interest and a reasonable facility with maths. And of course, you need to have basic mathematical skills to actually pass an engineering degree. Lots of engineers perhaps don't use it afterwards, but having finished my undergraduate degree in engineering, I thought I'd be an engineering academic. So I went on and did a PhD in a highly mathematical topic. What I thought at the time was actually not all that practical, but I wasn't terribly worried by that, because after all, PhD thesis, as long as it gets through the examiners and gets you a PhD, doesn't really matter whether anybody ever uses it again. But it turns out that the field I worked in, and in particular the supervisor I had, has become quite an important area of design, and particularly where we have these days very powerful computers, and some of that early work that was done in this field of optimum design is now being built into very sophisticated computer programs that are used to work out the appropriate arrangement of structures in things like aircraft wings and so forth. I might add that the computing requirements for that sort of thing were beyond what was available in when I did my PhD. The size of mainframes then we thought were pretty powerful computers, but to give you a comparison, what I thought was the big mainframe computer that I was using at Monash had 400,000 transistors in it. This iPhone has 10 billion.
Yeah, I've heard. I'm not sure if it's true. Someone told me that sort of a Casio, a basic Casio watch, has more computing power than the first Apollo that went to the moon. It's incredible,
yes,
isn't
yes,
it? The change in computing.
It is.
And presumably you were using, you know, punch cards and all this rather than just
exactly.
Back then.
The user interface was not all that user friendly.
But then you sort of transitioned. You decided that purely being academic wasn't enough, and so you went into industry. And was it difficult to transition?
The first job I had in industry in a consulting engineering firm, I used my computing skills. This was at days when very few engineers had any real knowledge of the application of computers, so that was a marketable skill at that point. Mm-hmm. But that was the first consulting firm I worked for, but then I changed after 4 or 5 years and went to another firm that was more multidisciplinary or dealing with things like mining projects, offshore platforms and so forth. And I ended up as a design engineer, project manager. Some of the projects I had teams of up to 15, 20 engineers that I was working on. And I think that sort of experience showed me that there are actually some very different skills from the technical engineers from the project managers. Their emphasis on the elements of time, cost and quality are in fact very different. There are some extremely good technical engineers who are not very good project managers, and vice versa. They're both very necessary, of course, but important to recognise that they do require very different sets of skills.
Were you already at that point able to go out to the projects, to site, to get a real feel, or was that, you know,
the
office?
Work we did,
had you already started to travel?
Didn't spend very much time on site. Most of it was pure design. I did travel in terms of, we had a joint venture in Indonesia. We had a joint venture with an American firm for offshore design. That was mostly in the West. So I did do a reasonable amount of travel at that point. I've done a lot more since I changed careers.
And so what I wanted to sort of find was, what became the driver, the impetus for you? Because you've already changed from an engineer. Was yours a general engineering degree, or were there degrees of specialism that you sort of took in one of the... I asked, because my son has finished an engineering degree, and I didn't really think about it. Obviously, there are so many different types of engineers: civil engineer, structural engineer, mechanical engineer, electrical engineer, so on and so forth. But actually, not that many courses give students that wide range of options. And I wonder what it was like when you did your degree.
I attended Monash, the second year of existence. So the classes that I was in were very small. But even at that stage, the first year of engineering, in fact, perhaps the first 2 years were the same for everyone, but in third year, it split into four different streams, civil engineering, mechanical, electrical, and chemical. And then a few years later, there was also materials engineering. Now, civil engineering is a very broad field in itself. It covers traffic, hydraulics, geotechnical, structural, I was always interested in the structural engineering because of the mathematics and the precision.
And still, presumably that's what's led you into the sort of the computing side as well.
That's right. Your question was about the different branches. It's still basically those four or five different streams, and there's a certain ability to do some electives, for instance, but a basic undergraduate degree in engineering is still very general. You know, civil engineering, you've got only the basics in each of those areas, and I think a lot more people these days do master's degrees. You can do master's by coursework, focus on the specialty you want, and I think that's probably necessary given the way in which technology advances so quickly.
Did you realise at that time that you had, or did you even recognise it, that you have quite a voracious appetite for learning? Because, you know, you did your degree, PhD, you taught as well, didn't you, at Monash? But then we're coming on to a sort of the time in the late 90s where actually you went back to university to qualify as a lawyer. I mean, you know, why would you do that? Why do you want to do more? Put yourself through it.
Well, I guess there are a couple of reasons. Was a director of the consulting engineering firm, and we sold the business to an American firm. Some of the fun went out of it. You know, the management changed. We were no longer masters of our own destiny, as it were. I had the opportunity of giving up engineering and trying something new. And I'd spent the last few years, I'd spent a lot of time with lawyers. First of all, I had to do quite a bit of work on the sale process. Australia has a very stringent capital gains tax regime, and if we didn't structure the sale appropriately, we could have ended up with two lots of capital gains tax, which would have meant that it wasn't worth doing at all. So I spent time with lawyers, but in the end, I came up with the appropriate structure for that. Our firm also ended up with a couple of very large writs, one of which went the full distance through the Supreme Court of Western Australia and the Court of Appeal. We did win, I might add, but again, had to spend a lot of time with lawyers, and I decided that perhaps I could do this as well. So
We're clearly lucky not to lose you to the dark side of tax, but it's not often I hear people who spent a long time with lawyers and then actually want to become one. Most of the time, people who spend a long time with lawyers never want to see one again in their life. And I suppose you had a natural inclination towards construction.
I guess when I first started the law degree, I was thinking of a complete change, and I hadn't really mapped out what my legal career would be, other than thinking that to get admitted at the Supreme Court in Victoria, you need more than a law degree. You need some form of practical legal training, and a lot of people in those days did articles with a big law firm. Because of my age, I didn't think I was going to be able to get articles, so I did a diploma course at Monash University that gave me the appropriate legal practice skills that enabled me to be admitted. In fact, in my final semester as an undergraduate at Melbourne University, they introduced a Master of Construction Law course, and I actually enrolled a couple of subjects while I was still finishing off my undergraduate degree, and realised that this was the ideal legal field for me to work in. I think the law involved in construction is very interesting. I like the black letter contract law, which is most of what we deal with. But clearly construction law also enables me to use my years of experience in engineering and construction. I understand the other side of it. I particularly understand the challenges that designers face, having been on the receiving end of writs and so forth. So,
I think it's an unusual skill. I mean, to compare you, for example, Sir Vivian Ramsay, no longer a TCC judge, but he was one of the first, I think, English judges to come from a sort of dual qualification, because he was originally an engineer as well. And I think that that always shone through in his handling of cases and the decisions he came to. I think it's interesting that you were, you can't even be described as a late bloomer, because you were blooming already. But it's an interesting couple of thoughts and interest on what you think. Do you think that it is easier now for people who've had a career, and let's just keep it in the same directional flow, so they've been an engineer, do you think it's easier now or harder if you've been an engineer to qualify as a lawyer? Do you think that's something that should be made easier from your personal experience, encouraged?
Certainly encouraged. I don't think there are any real difficulties in that transition if people have the drive to want to do it. One of the things I'd say about an engineering degree is it's extremely good training in thinking and problem solving and logic. Interestingly, I understand that the cabinet of Singapore has many engineers in it. I'm not sure if they've ever actually practiced engineering, but and I think one of our big merchant banks in Australia, Macquarie Bank, I think has quite a lot of engineers involved, because they've clearly usually got mathematical skills, but also the ability to think logically, to work out what are the important issues, the ability to ignore the things that don't really have a big impact. Any engineer who really wants to make the change to study law, the biggest challenge I think will be in the English language skills, because or whatever language they're working in, because engineers are not renowned necessarily as being good communicators or necessarily good with the written word.
I think, yeah, recognise that. It's a difficult thing. I think it's a shame that more people don't recognise that you can do a degree and then subsequently become a lawyer. People see the law in too linear a fashion. I think I'm fifth generation lawyer, and in my family it was very much a linear. You know, if you want to be a lawyer, which was pretty much expected, although, God, I was far too thick and lazy. I don't know how I made it. But it was perceived, it was pushed to you that you must do a law degree. And the concept of doing a different sort of degree was never something I even understood. I didn't even know you could do that until later. And yet now, here I am at my advanced age, and I positively encourage it. And I think your story is similar. Coming from a different educational background, engineering just brings a totally different dynamic, doesn't it, to problem solving and discussions. And I think that's something, particularly with the area that you have gone into, construction, that's invaluable.
There are a lot of young people and not so young people studying these days who, in fact, do a double degree, law with something else, law, commerce, law, science, sometimes law, engineering. That, of course, can be a long, hard row. I know a young lady who is now a partner of one of the bigger law firms in Australia. She did an engineering and a law degree, 6 years. She then had to make the very difficult decisions whether she was going to have a career as an engineer or as a lawyer.
Yeah.
Ultimately, she chose the law.
And, of course, you've taken all your skills that you've learned in all these things, because you're now a prolific author as well, and I've been very honoured to chapter one of your books. But to sing your praises, you've produced a whole series of books explaining, and if I say making accessible, making FIDIC accessible. Did you realise when you started doing those that it was more than a textbook?
They are practical legal guides. In fact, one of the book reviews of one of my books, the reviewer said specifically that this is not a legal textbook like the books on construction law written by Julian Bailey, for instance. So that's quite true. They are not aimed at the same audience. We have the title of practical legal guide, practical, because the appeal is for a broad cross section of people in the construction industry. Yes, lawyers, but also engineers, architects, project managers, quantity surveyors, people who are dealing with contract in their day-to-day life and need to understand how these operate in the particular jurisdiction that they're in. And this is where those FIDIC books, I think, do fulfill a very valuable need. There are a lot of very good textbooks on using FIDIC contracts from a legal perspective, but I don't think anybody had attempted to do what we've done in those books, that is working from a template so that each chapter addresses the issues in much the same way, but showing how FIDIC can and should be used in those jurisdictions. What are the things to look out for? What are the things that are different? And it's been a very rewarding exercise, and I've been very grateful to all of those 100-plus authors of the various chapters, including your excellent chapter on England and Wales, which is very comprehensive.
But, thank you very much.
I think it's been a great journey, and in due course, I think there will be second editions, and we can put in some of the jurisdictions that we've so far missed out on. I might add some of the perhaps important jurisdictions that may have been missed have only been missed because I haven't to date been able to get authors prepared to put in the hard yards to actually do the writing. As you would know, it's not a task to be tackled lightly. There's a lot of effort involved, and people have busy professional lives.
Oh, I think it's very much something that as authors, I don't know if I'm speaking for all, but it's something that you take on with that degree of enthusiasm, because I've been whipped into a frenzy of eagerness to do it and the promises of glory to come from you. And then, of course, you look at actually what's involved. So from your point of view, what are the difficulties in getting authors to produce? What are some of the issues you've had to face in getting the editors of the chapters to actually do what we promised?
It's the time is the biggest issue of all. I'm always very, very careful about defining what I hope are realistic dates. Too long in advance, people will never start. Too short, they'll probably not even accept challenge in the first instance. But of course, these four of these books were actually written, started during COVID, and I guess that added an extra dimension of difficulty on top of sort of normal busy professional lives.
Have you had some good excuses from people as to why they haven't progressed?
Oh, I don't ever really pursue the excuses. I just try and encourage them to give me a realistic time. in some cases, I've ultimately had to, even though I really wanted the chapter, I had to say, well, if you can't do it by such and such a date, then I'm afraid we'll have to go to print without it. On the other hand, there have been other chapters that I've felt were so important that I've had to delay submission of the book until that chapter was done.
Do you think your sort of people management skills is something that you've sort of honed then over the years? Do you think that was that helped you when you were doing the books, or?
Well, I'm sure it did, because I suppose if I didn't approach people the right way, they would take the easy route and say no. I'm very conscious that it's a big job for people. It's not easy. It's time consuming. So I do hopefully try and handle people with kid gloves.
In turn, when you're sitting as, you know, arbitrator or a member of a tribunal, is that something that you are, or you're conscious of, that that's an additional skill set that you've had to learn and practice? Because, you know, you get the engineering issues being presented to you, you get the legal issues, but then how do you deal with people from just different countries who have different traditions and ways of speaking?
I guess, you know, you always have to listen try and understand where people are coming from and their different perspectives. You need to be aware clearly of cultural differences because they're very significant in lots of situations. No matter how old and how experienced you might be, I think, you know, it's a lifelong learning exercise. I still learn new things on every matter, every tribunal I sit on, every group of people I come across, I learn new things. I think, you know, you have to be open to always learning. There's never any end to all of that.
One of my first bosses, Francis Kirkham, who became a judge, used to say to me, "You should learn something new every day. Every day you should be aiming to learn something." When you're looking at, say, tribunals, have you seen their composition change? Do you see greater diversity from either, whether you're looking at, you know, more women or a greater geographical spread with tribunals that you
sit on? There's certainly a lot more emphasis on it. I'm not sure how effective that push has been to date, you know, given the emphasis that's put on diversity. You know, we look at the journals and so forth, and so it's a very topical issue and a continually challenging one.
And do you think we in the profession can do, do you think we can do more to improve diversity in both of, you know, gender and, say, geography and the rest? Do you think that it's, what's going to help that most? Education or just access to, you know, What would you do to help change?
I don't think I have any silver bullet. I think it does require a change in perspectives and willingness to do things differently to the way they've been done in the past. Important to give younger people, perhaps people with less experience, also an opportunity. How do people get experience on dispute boards, for instance, if they've never been appointed to one? In Australia, we've been trying for a few years on three-person boards to persuade the parties that it's good to have a new, certainly qualified person, but someone without experience on a dispute board, so that we increase the gene pool. You know, we need more, and we need younger people coming on, because those of us who are there right now are not going to be around forever. We're getting older every year, and it's important to bring on the next generation, and very important to have that diversity of gender and cultural background and so forth. And I think you know, wherever one has an opportunity of nominating people to tribunals, it should be something that's carefully thought through. Is there somebody that's got the right sort of skills that you might not have otherwise thought of?
And do you see that reflected? Because you're also, quite apart from all your other achievements, you now teach on the construction course, don't you?
I do.
And do you see more women on that?
In fact, often there is even a majority of women. The course I co-teach at Melbourne University is on international construction law. We taught the last course in December last year. We had about 28 people. I think we had from 11 different countries. And at a guess, I'd say there were at least an equal number of women as men, and from a range of disciplines.
There's a big change, isn't there?
There is. In fact, I think the enrolments in law schools in Australia is more than 50% women. But of course, that's not yet reflected at the higher levels in the profession. It's changing, but it is taking time.
Yeah, I think retention within construction engineering is still an issue. I'm interested that you say you have people from so many different countries attend the course in Melbourne. Was that intended? Do you know? Is Melbourne sort of a focus point for countries within, you know, the Asia sort of area?
Not just the Asia Pacific area, but even South America. Yes, it's very deliberate. I think the Master of Construction Law course in Melbourne, which has now been running for over 20 years, is highly regarded, and I think is on a par with the King's College course in London. The subjects are taught, the majority of subjects are taught by leading practitioners from major law firms, barristers, and so forth. Yes, some are delivered by academics in Melbourne University, but most of the sort of really well-known construction lawyers in Australia are involved in teaching those courses. And we always make sure, for instance, we in our course on international construction law that we have a range of guest speakers. We've had Sir Vivian Ramsay and Sir Rupert Jackson on several occasions, for instance.
Both really, really good speakers.
Indeed.
That's something I know, you know, through the Barton Legal webinars that I'm very keen on encouraging people to share knowledge and experience. And I think that's borne out by what you say about the people, the diversity of countries that are on your course, because we forget that for a lot of people in different countries, they don't have the same access to that sort of construction pool of knowledge, do they?
No.
Unless these courses are run, it makes it very difficult. And I think you and I also share a similar view that the construction law sort of transcends people's normal issues of jurisdictional differences and the split between, you know, common law and civil law. I think you have a similar view to me that actually construction law is something that you can study across the globe. There are differences, of course. Do you think
it, very, very much so? To use, as we lawyers love to use Latin phrases, I think there is a lex constructionis. The similarities in the practice of construction law around the world in all the different jurisdictions, I think the similarities are much more than the differences. And we might use different route, to get to the result. But I think if you took a given factual scenario, there's almost universal agreement on what's the a fair and just outcome in that situation. The civil law, common law divide is more form than substance in many ways, I think, because I think there are really basic matters of let's call it justice and fairness that are universal. And important when you think about it, because global commerce in general and international construction law in particular is fundamentally dependent upon contracts actually working, being complied with. Because if we didn't have that, I think the world would be a very different place.
I think absolutely right. I find it frustrating that there are so many different types of contract, but the issues that arise in them are, yes, there are legal differences, but it's invariably due to, in my view, a lack of planning, preparation, a lack of collaboration between the parties. And the way in which many clauses are drafted within contracts, it doesn't actually matter whether you're in a civil law or a common law jurisdiction. And I think that, absolutely, as you said, the people that populate construction and engineering should do more to share their experiences and knowledge to help others. So on that sort of line, what's a top tip that you would give to somebody who's appearing either as a member of a dispute avoidance board or a dispute avoidance board for the first time? What's your sort of top tip for someone coming through?
That's a hard one because there's so many things that one would be encouraging such a person to be on top of. They certainly need to have an understanding of the fundamentals of contract law. The most important thing is comes back to this whole issue of communication and listening. You need to listen to what the parties that are saying about the issues, dispute board. The main role in many ways is to promote that communication between the parties to help them avoid disputes. That's the most successful dispute board of all, where you never actually have a dispute to deal with. And I've certainly been on a few of those in Australia where the avoidance function has worked extremely well.
And that's very important. And sort of drawing strands together, are any of your grandchildren, are they budding carpenters?
My son is more than a budding carpenter. He's taken up carpentry in quite a big way recently, and he now has a better equipped workshop than mine. I have to go around to his place sometimes for particular specialist tools. In terms of grandchildren, I do have one granddaughter who is doing second year of law, although I'm not sure that she's going to do construction law. And I also have a niece who's... I'm really trying to get into construction law. She's been an associate for a couple of judges in the Supreme Court in Victoria, but at the moment she says she wants to work in industrial relations, and I'm trying to talk her out of that.
Send her over to Leeds, Donald.
Yes, I think that would be a very good idea.
Encouraging younger people, you know, I mentioned carpentry, but it's encouraging younger people. Construction is such a diverse area of law. You think you can do everything from buildings to bridges to sewage works to nuclear. You can be involved in airports. It's just and travel. What are the things you're most looking forward to in the next year? What do you see 2024 as being things that you'd like to, you know, sort of put a big tick in the box against?
I'm on a couple of dispute boards in the Philippines on a big metro project there. So I'd like to see that project proceeding well and gaining the advantages of having a dispute board. I'm also involved in editing a book called Technology Contracts for Construction and Infrastructure Projects. And in many ways, that's perhaps even more challenging than the FEDIC books. This is trying to address the disconnect, if you like, between the construction people who are procuring, building and procuring infrastructure construction projects that involve these days inevitably significant technology elements, and yet the technology people don't understand the construction issues and vice versa.
Well, yes, as ever was.
And I think, and in fact, I'm using this as a case study in the book, whilst we've got some very eminent practitioners, partners of law firms and so forth, IT people writing the various chapters. I'm writing a chapter on case studies, and great case study is Crossrail in London. The great thing about Crossrail is that there's a vast amount of material available in the public domain, but it's a paradigm case that underlines the theme of the book, because in 2018, when Crossrail was supposed to be opened, it was realised that the technology aspects needed a lot more work to be integrated. And whilst they only, on my calculations, only amounted to something like 6% of the total cost of the project, but everyone thinks of it as being a big civil engineering project, but that 6% took about 3 years to actually integrate and make work. And clearly you can't open a metro train line without a functioning signalling system and so forth. Of course, Crossrail is a very sophisticated, I think it's called the world's first fully digital railway. So it's a great example of where it's necessary to deal with the technology component appropriately. Mm. It's not just another subcontract that you can deal with the same way as the reinforcement or the excavation and so forth.
And that's the way with, as you say, contracts that are in some countries ever more complicated, and then the degree to which, you know, the right people with the right training and the right experience are brought in and introduced. Donald, I love the fact that I can talk to you. One of my favourite sounds in the world, which we haven't managed to hear today, is the international dialing tone. I mention this to people because they think I'm completely barking mad. But I love the fact that technology enables us, hours and hours of difference, thousands of miles apart, you know, we can look at each other, see each other via a screen. We can have a conversation. I'm honoured to, I hope, you know, to be able to call you a friend. I think you've got such an array of talents that people, because you're a very, very modest bloke, we've barely touched on them. I've really enjoyed talking to you. We'll definitely, as they say, circle around and come back and have another chat and do more of your talents from your pages and pages and pages of experience and CV, because I'd like to have an opportunity to talk to you about some of the actual matters where you've been a tribunal and look at some of the issues you've had to sort of deal with in detail, because I think there's some incredible education pieces there for other people to listen to. I'm very grateful for you staying up. I must be quite late now with you. Been a joy to see you and a pleasure as ever.
Thanks very much, Bill. It was great talking with you.
Thank you for joining me for today's Barton Legal podcast. Please make sure you follow the show in your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be tackling another important topic in this month's Barton Legal webinar, and you can register for free and watch back our previous webinars at bartonlegal.com. Why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn and follow Barton Legal to keep up to date with all the legal trends and news? I look forward to speaking to you again in the next Barton Legal podcast.